let's start with my sobriety date. It's June 1st of 2006. I was born and raised in Arizona. I am the oldest of three kids. I have two little brothers. I grew up in what I would term probably a pretty alcoholic home. I didn't take my first drink until 13, and I didn't have any like big experience with it or anything. I will tell you that I did not do a lot of drinking, and since this is a young people's meeting, I will talk about what I did do a little bit. My thing was meth. That's really what I did. But I have found out recently after doing some step up with my sponsor that I have some things going on with alcohol that aren't normal, that I didn't even realize or acknowledge until like a couple of weeks ago, which was pretty eye-opening for me at almost 7.5 years of sobriety. My mom was divorced. I grew up with my grandfather and my mom. My grandpa died when I was 13, and I drank right after he passed away because I couldn't handle what was happening. I went through high school. Nothing big happened. I drank randomly at parties. Like, there was no, like, anything that really happened. My big deal in high school was guys. Like, I could not stay away from them. I didn't care if they were yours. I was going to take them, and that's kind of how I got powered up. Pretty alcoholic. So, you know, I will go on to say I am 41 years old. I didn't start doing anything out of control until I was 28. But basically, at 18 years old, I went into the Navy. I met my first husband there. We dated 4 months, got engaged, was married 2 months later. I was 19 years old at the time. I was married for 10 years, and so all of my 20s I was married. At 25 I had my daughter, at 28 I had my son. I went through a divorce at 28, and that's literally when my whole life fell apart. I got into a situation where, first and foremost, I grew up in a household where drugs were not okay. And I'll just backtrack a minute. The reason why I'm an alcoholic has nothing to do with alcohol whatsoever. I have a spiritual condition, a malady, and an allergy, and a craving that I cannot control once I put a substance in my body. And it doesn't matter what it is, because to me it always tastes like more, and I cannot stop on my own. Something bigger than me has to stop me. My experience getting sober was always going to jail. I didn't go to treatment. I didn't do any of that. I got arrested, and I would go away for 10 weeks at a time. So after I started going through my separation, right before it happened, I started smoking weed with my ex-husband. Now, I didn't believe in that when I was growing up. I was very anti-drug everything. But what I was trying to do was keep him with me. I wanted him to stay, and I knew the girl that he was with smoked weed. So I felt if I could be like her, he would want to stay with me. So that would lead me into my codependency, which is very, very severe. And I am a people pleaser, and I will go to any extreme to keep you in my life. I will become who I think you want me to be versus who I truly am. And I didn't know who I truly was until I was 34 years old sitting in prison. I had absolutely no idea. I could not take care of myself. I'd never paid for anything. It was always somebody else's responsibility. And when it was always someone else's responsibility, I never took responsibility. It was theirs. And then I could blame them and be a victim, and that's kind of how I rolled for a lot of my life. I never felt like I fit in. I was always looking for a way to be accepted, and I never really found that truly until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So after that happened with my ex-husband, I ended up moving back to Arizona. I'd been gone for 10 years, and I got into a situation where the month after I got here, my ex-husband wanted our daughter, so I sent her back to him because he was heartbroken, and I did not want to be the parent that was like, no, you can't see your kids, I'm sorry. I would not put my kids in the middle of that because it wasn't their fault that me and their father could not get along and live together anymore, that we did not love one another. And I refused, absolutely refused to do that to my kids. So I had him come and get her. And so that was February 13th of 2001. It's been about 6 months or so. We're going into July. And I had contacted my ex-husband and let him know I wanted to come and get her. I wanted my daughter, and he said I was going to have to fly out to get her. So I made some arrangements at the place where I was working to get a pay advance to go out and get my daughter. And when I went to go pick up that pay advance, what I got was a severance check and all my stuff in a box. So what I did do is I called him, and I told him that he needed to come and get our son. Our son had just turned 1 year old. So he flew out to get him, and this was the day that everything was going to change, although I was not really aware that it was going to change in the way that it was going to. I was going to walk through a door that I did not see coming. So he flew out to get our son. That was August 11th of 2001. That's the day I signed my child support agreement, my custody agreement, and my divorce papers. I did not fight my divorce because I was terrified of my ex-husband. It was not a great marriage. He was unfaithful and violent, and he was, at that point in time, my God, I thought what he said went, and I just did what he wanted. Because I did not have a voice, and I did not know how to stand up for myself. So I basically just signed away for my kids, and I didn't fight for them. So he flew out with my son, our son, August 13th of 2001. And I was not okay on that day. As he was walking down the terminal with our son, and my son was still in diapers. He had just barely taken his first steps a couple months before that. He was just kind of learning how to talk. He was still a baby. It took everything in me to not run down, grab my son, and say, "You can't have my baby." You know, and it ripped my heart out to watch my little boy over his shoulder going further and further from me. It even killed me more when his little face popped up in the airplane window. And I lost it. Like, I was in a pile on the floor at the airport, Phoenix, you know, Sky Harbor, like a hot mess. And it took a long time for me to calm down enough to call the guy I was dating and tell him to bring something home that night, because I could not absolutely feel what I was feeling. I was going to die if it didn't go away. And that's really how I felt, because I had no tools to cope with what was going on. I didn't know what to do. So I went to my best friend's house, hung out, and then I went to his house. And that was the very first night I smoked crack. Went on a 3-week run with that, and then was like, I can't do this anymore. And that's when I had the ability to stop. I could stop on my own. So around this time, I went back into an industry that is not legal. I'm not going to go into what it is because it's a mixed meeting and it's not appropriate, but it wasn't legal. And I'd gone to work one day, and I was really hungover because I'd gone out the night before and drank myself sick. And one of the girls that I worked with said that she had something that would help me to have a little bit more energy if I wanted it. And I was like, all right, because the night before, me and the guy I was dating had just talked about meth, just talked about how wonderful it was and everything good for you. So when she told me that's what it was, I was all over that, because I needed to find out what the big deal was. So I found out what the big deal was, and my life was never, ever, ever the same after that. It became everything. It took control of everything about who I was and changed me into a monster. I'm going to kind of speed up a little bit so we don't get too much stuck in all this past stuff, but, you know, I was out for 5 years. In that span of 5 years, I went from being law-abiding to a convicted felon with 4 felonies on her record that never goes away. I violated my probation twice. I went to prison for 2 years. I was away from my children for 9 years. My daughter was 4. My son was 1 the last time I saw them. Now, when I finally got sober in 2006, again, it was getting arrested, because I could not stay sober outside of being locked up. And that's how I heard about AA, was in county, sitting in Estrella Jail, and they would come in, and I would go. And at first, it was just to get the hell out of the dorm, because those girls are crazy, and I needed a break. But I would go, and I would kind of hear what you were talking about, but I was always so separate, because I didn't drink. I didn't drink alcohol. I don't like alcohol. But today I know that if something happened with one of my kids or my husband and I didn't have a program, I would drink until I couldn't feel, until I did not have to feel the pain in my heart. If I don't have my higher power and I don't have a program in my life, that is exactly what I would do today. Now, 7.5 years ago, that is not what I thought I would do, but it is my truth today, and I know that. So by the time I finally made it to prison, what it looked like for me, I had no material possessions whatsoever. They were gone. My ex-husband was going to sever my rights as my kid's mother. He was going to take them from me because I was MIA. My daughter was acting out and having emotional problems, and my son had no clue who I was. And another woman was raising him. And when I finally, 12 hours before I got arrested the last time, I was miserable. I had been out of county for 4 months, and I wanted to die. And I basically had it out with my higher power. I said, you either help me or I'm taking myself out. I cannot live like this anymore, and I don't know what to do. Now, I had no idea that my higher power was going to have me arrested 12 hours later, but thank God, because I had to be uprooted out from what I was doing and taken away from everybody. Because if you put me around somebody that I can still go get high with or drink with, that's what's going to happen. So I had a big time out and got taken away. You know, and the very first day that I got to my cell at Perryville, and the door closed and there was no one in there but me and my higher power, because my roommate hadn't made it in yet, I hit the ground, face first on the ground, and I just cried and sobbed and asked my higher power. I pleaded with him. I said, I will do whatever you want. Just help me change my life. I will die if this doesn't change. I'm going to die out there, and I need you to help me. Now, I didn't feel any better after that. It wasn't like I got up and it was all pink clouds and I loved everything. I was still very, very angry, and I acted out a lot. And thank God I was locked up for my first year, because I was not a nice person. I was very mean, and I was very angry, and I acted out a lot. And in prison, you can't get kicked out of there if you act out. They just give you more, a little bit more time. So, you know. Thankfully, that's where I went. And today, I'm very, very grateful for prison, because that's where everything changed for me. You know, and what I did do in there is I went to meetings. I went to every meeting that had an A on it. I didn't care what it was. Al-Anon, AA, and everything. I went to everything that had any kind of an A that would help me change. I went through treatment my last year in prison. I went through a treatment program, and it gave me my foundation for coming out back into society. And while I was there, I kept hearing about a program in Prescott called Winner, and I heard that they would help you become a house manager. And I really wanted to work in sobriety. I wanted to work in recovery more than anything, and it came to me like the first couple weeks I had been locked up, and I didn't know if that would be possible for me. I didn't really know if anything I had been through could help anybody. But there had to be a reason for all of it, and that's what I kept thinking. And I just said a little prayer, if this is your will for me, please let me know and open a door for me. And so that's what I kept hearing about, was Prescott and Winter, and it's great, and you need to go. I never heard anything negative. So I started to write them. And I wrote them so much that they finally called me and interviewed me to come in. And I told them I was willing to do anything. I didn't care if it meant sleeping in a ditch, digging ditches, sleeping on the ground, like scrubbing toilets. I didn't care what they wanted me to do. I was very willing to do it. The desperation, hopelessness, and powerlessness that I felt, I never ever wanted to feel again in my life. Because I couldn't live, I couldn't breathe, I couldn't do anything in that. And all I wanted to do was die. And at one point I almost did. I took two bottles of pills and I laid down. Because my psyche had snapped, it had been up too long. And I woke up 4 days later, restrained in a hospital, half clothed, and I have no memory. John C. Lincoln on 17 in Deer Valley, that's the hospital I woke up in. And today, even when I drove by it, I have no idea what happened in there. What I've been told is I punched a nurse and kept trying to rip my IVs out, and they had to restrain me to keep me safe. And that was in 2005. And a normal person would probably stop after all that, but I just went full force after I got out of the hospital, because that's what I do. You know, so I got out of prison on May 5th of 2008. I went to Prescott, Arizona. I went into Winter, and I did everything that they told me. I mean, I didn't do my program perfectly, but I was very willing to do what they told me. I got a sponsor. I completed my steps in the 7 months that I was there. I did not even graduate on time because I was in the middle of training to become what I wanted to do. But the date of graduation didn't matter. It just mattered where I graduated, which was in Prescott, because they knew me there. They had seen what I had gone through and all the work I had done, and that was the most important thing to me in the whole wide world. And, you know, I have been through my steps several times. I'm currently going through them again, with my sponsor. I have a life that is unbelievable to me. I cannot even believe right now that I'm standing up here like talking to all of you, because I never dreamed when I got sober that anything like this would be happening to an alcoholic like me. Because of the things that I did, I feel I don't deserve any of this, but I have a higher power that tells me because of the work I do, yes, I absolutely do. You know, I get to sponsor these amazing women. I have an amazing sponsor who really this last year has walked me through the most painful year of my life. My daughter, who will be turning 17 on Sunday, I had to check her into treatment in August. And I could barely breathe when that was happening, because the last thing I wanted in all the world was my little baby girl to be like me in that way. But thank God for this program and the women in this program that came and like came up alongside me and helped me walk through it, because it was so hard for me. And she's doing really good today. She just got 2 months on Monday, and she's doing well. You know, there's a couple of things that I've been taught in this program. Like, girls should stick with girls, guys should stick with guys. Not the best idea to get in a relationship in your first year, because you really, truly need to be working on yourself. You know, and I did that. Like, you know, my first 2.5 years, that's really all I did. Now y'all like really weirded out about that, but that is what I was taught. Like, you know, because girls can help girls and guys can help guys. Like, and that's the way, that's what I've learned. You know, going to meetings, having sponsees, working with my sponsor, being honest, practicing, you know, everything that this program has taught me is what I believe the reason why I'm still sober today. I'm still willing to do whatever is asked of me. I may argue about it a little bit, but I'm very willing, very, very willing to do it. I have amazing friends in my life, and I know in my heart that absolutely none of this would be possible without Alcoholics Anonymous and without the steps and the traditions and every single thing that the Big Book tells me and the 12 and 12 explains to me about the Big Book. It all goes together in this one giant recipe that changes my life, and it changes who I am. Because if you guys had seen me 7.5 years ago, you would not even recognize me. And the girls in my town, I've shown them my prison picture, and it doesn't look like me. I was so angry, and I wanted to hurt anything that came in my path. If you didn't have something I wanted, then I didn't want anything to do with you. And I didn't know how to be a friend or be a wife or show up for anybody, because it was always just about me. And today I get amazing opportunities to actually, I have girls that call me and want to sit down and have coffee with me. I have sponsees that want to do work with me, and it's amazing. And I have a sponsor that I want to work with. It's not like I want to, and I have to, or I'm not going to live. And because of this program, my kids have their mom back. My husband has a wife who's faithful and honest, and my friends have someone that will show up for them. And again, none of this would happen if I had not done every single thing that had been told me and everything that the book told me. I didn't really question the book because I knew my own thinking got me where I was. So if you're new and none of this makes sense, it's probably not going to make sense until you get a sponsor who can explain it to you so that it makes sense to you. If you're sitting on the fence, whether you want to do work or not do work, I can tell you 3 years ago, I was so dry I almost went back out. I didn't want to do this anymore. And thank God my higher power intervened, and instead of calling the girl down here that I knew, whose name was Veronica, I ended up calling my sponsor, whose name started with an S. Those numbers aren't anywhere near each other. And I recommitted to my program, and I have not stopped since. Because 9 years after being away from my children, I was reunited with them. And I have an amazing relationship with both of them. I have a pretty good relationship with my ex-husband. I actually got to see him this year. In August after 12 years, and it was okay. I mean, we didn't fight, we got along, and that's way better when it was like 10 years ago when we got divorced. Way, way better. So I've been pretty much involved in ASCIPA since 2009. I am really thankful for WIPA because you guys really just accepted me, regardless of my age. And it's given me something to do, like service and being involved and like helping people that I don't even ever get to meet. And that's a big deal to me, to like that people trust me and I get to be responsible. But it's because of you guys that that happens, you know. And I'm eternally grateful to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because I know, like, if we didn't have this program, I don't really know where I would be. I can't imagine where any of us would be, you know. So if you're new, please stay. You know, if you guys have been here for a while, reach your hand out to the newcomer because they need it. They're scared. And a lot of them won't come up to us. We need to go to them. If you can remember where you were, when I was brand new in prison, I was terrified and I just acted out a lot. There wasn't a lot of love going on in there. But out here, we can be very loving and tolerant of one another. And that's what I get told, and that's what I try every day to do. Some days not as good as others, but I do try my hardest. I have a strong connection with my higher power. When it all goes crazy, that's who I go to first, and then I go hit up my sponsor. And then my 18. So I don't regret anything in my life, even though some of it was really bad, because it all led me to who I am today. And thankfully, Alcoholics Anonymous has always been there and will always be there. So anybody bouncing in and out, like, please just come back. And all of you that are here and they come bouncing in and out, do not kick them. Do not kick the wounded, you guys. We're supposed to love them so that they want to come back. Because you never know if one day one of those people are saving your kids' lives, for those of you that are going to have children or currently have kids. You know, and I never want to be the reason that one person, I say something crazy to somebody and they never come back, they go out and die. I don't want that. So I always do my very best to be kind and loving, no matter how many times they come in and out. Because I've had some people in my life that have come in and out. And I have somebody right now that's currently out that used to be my sponsor. And all I can do is tell her I love her and let her know I'm here for her. And that's our job. Love and tolerance of others is our code. It's in the book. It's in there more than once. And it's repeated because we need to be reminded. So I think that's all I have. And thank you for letting me be of service.
Thank you, Elaine. Now for tonight's main speaker, I'm pleased to introduce Alonzo from Phoenix, Arizona. Please help me welcome Alonzo.
Thank you. All right, let me set my little timer here. My name's Alonzo. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Alonzo. We love you, Alonzo. Lots and lots and lots. And
thank you for the pelvic thrust. My sobriety date is December 19th, 1997. I have a sponsor. His name's Terry. I have a home group. It's the Monday night meditation meeting in Phoenix, 2nd Street in McDowell. We have a format of reading a piece of AA literature, meditating in silence for 20 minutes, and then rereading that reading and then sharing. And it's a great group, so if you're interested in expanding maybe your meditation practice, please come talk to me and I can point you in that direction. This has been a great year for Phoenix, Arizona as a whole, but Phoenix as far as YPAW. You know, we started off the year with Wacky Paw on native land for the first time in AA history. And that was a really, really good conference. I was able to participate in that and talk about, my panel was, had something to do with, being a gang member or ex-gang member, Gangs to Glory or something like that. Is that right?
Yeah.
Gangs to Grace. Thank you. And then Icky Paw, International Conference of People. That was just here in July, and man, what a party, what a great event, and I was able to participate in that as well and speak on emotional sobriety. And now ASCII Paul here, and I want to thank the host committee for allowing me to be able to participate in my sobriety and allowing me to come up and share. Let's see, so you know, this has been kind of a tough year and some months for me. In fact, it's been, I've heard people say this before, that this has been their toughest year. And I've never had that experience up until this year. So I don't know exactly what's going to come out, but let's see what happens. So I was born and raised in the good part of South Central Los Angeles. And I lived there till I was about in seventh grade, and ever since I can remember, I felt different then. I remember being about 3 years old, and I walked outside, and I wanted to play with the little kids, and my family was the only Spanish-speaking family in the neighborhood, and I started, you know, talking to the kids, and they proceeded to throw rocks at me, and you know, right away, I didn't feel a part of. When I was 5 years old, I would always walk to school with this one little girl, and one day I didn't go to school, and she got hit by a car and got killed. And I didn't really share my feelings with my teacher. I didn't cry about it with my parents. I kept it all in. I'm not sure where I learned that, but I learned that somewhere along the way. In first grade, if you talked in class, the teacher would hit you in the face with a ruler. And she didn't really get caught up until she pulled on some girl's ear and ended up with the earring in her hand. In second grade, I thought it was time for me to toughen up, and I started slicking my hair back and ironing my pants and listening to oldies, and I wanted to be like a little tough guy. And in third grade, I started getting in trouble as a result of those behaviors. And none of those things make me an alcoholic. Me being, really, really poor growing up, my parents having a second and third grade education doesn't make me an alcoholic. Being Hispanic does not make me an alcoholic, you know, gangs and all that type of stuff. I share that because, I would come into the rooms and I would hear you guys speak and I would only hear the differences, you know. This guy's older or younger than me. This person has more money. This person's been to prison or never been to jail. And whatever the difference was, I just kind of like attached to that, and it allowed me to not listen to you. It allowed me to not take the program as you guys were outlining it for me to do it. I would do the first three steps by myself. Forget those step four, you know, anything else. sponsor, that's okay for you, buddy. But, you know, I'm okay. And all these type of things. So I started drinking at a relatively young age, and I must have been like 7 or 9 years old, and I wasn't drinking necessarily for effect. I was drinking, well, I guess maybe somewhat for effect. I was drinking to be cool, to be a part of, to be, you know, I don't know, just one of the boys or whatever. And I have a big family. My mom has 10 brothers and sisters, and my dad has 13 brothers and sisters. You know, so every weekend there'd be a party. Someone's being born, or someone's getting married, or some reason to celebrate. And, you know, I would see that my uncles and different people, they would drink, and they were happy when they drank. Man, they would drink, and they would dance, and they would give me money, and like all this, like, cool stuff. And so me and a couple of my cousins that were about my same age, we grabbed a couple beers, went around the side of the house, and I proceeded to drink as much as I could, as fast as I could. And, you know, to tell you the truth, that's kind of how my drinking went. It stopped being cute at a young age. It wasn't, you know, I felt like maybe, I used to always think that it was cute, you know. But I remember hitting on, I think it was my cousin, you know, when I was about 9 years old, you know, and that was not cute to the parents of that cousin, you know, like, so it stopped being cute pretty early on. And I must have been like 13 or 14 years old. My parents decided that LA was probably not the best place to raise us, so we moved here to Phoenix, to the west side, what's now called Avondale. And you know, we went over there, and I only drank once in the 2 years that I lived there. And I got in a fight with some cowboys, and they threw me in a lake. So, like, I had kind of a resentment towards Arizona for a while. But then we moved, we moved to Orange County, California, and I lived over there. And, you know, everywhere I went, I would look for that group of people, the guys that were causing trouble and this type of stuff. And I was hanging out with these guys, and we're at the park, and you know, we had nothing to do. It was Friday night, and we all went to Rouse, which is a grocery store, and we each stole a bottle of Presidente, and we put it down our pants, and then we went to McDonald's, and we got the supersized cups, and we filled it up with ice and lemon, and then poured the Presidente in there, got rid of the bottle, lid, straw, went back to this park. I lived in one of those neighborhoods where we were constantly, you know, getting pulled over and asked, you know, or, you know, if we were walking somewhere, the police would say, hey, what are you guys doing, and this type of stuff. And so we figured the cops will never know, you know, like we thought we had them tricked. And this is when I first really felt the magic of alcohol, because my mind was constantly going. You know, I was thinking how I could impress her, if I should say this, if that was funny. No, you shouldn't say that. That's stupid. All the time passed, you know, all this stuff, and just constantly going. My mind was constantly attacking me, and I didn't even know that. And I took some sips of that alcohol, and all of a sudden, I had this feeling of, and man, that was magical. That was solution, you know? That was, I didn't even know I was looking for that. But when I got that, I wanted more of that, you know? And I continued to drink. And, you know, I blacked out that night, and I came to originally at Carl's Jr., and I was throwing up in front of this girl that I really liked, and I blacked out again, and I came to at the park, and the sprinklers had woke me up, and my friends were nowhere to be seen, you know, and that was the first time I slept at a park, but it wasn't the last. You know, I immediately got into outside issues. I spoke at a treatment center or something like that, adolescent treatment center, and someone posed the question, what was the first drug that you did? And I said, well, alcohol. And then they said, what about after that? And I said, LSD. And they said, man, you know, like, you don't mess around. And it was just, whatever, it was just, I don't know, someone just gave me something and said, hey, this is going to make you feel good. And I took it, and that was pretty much, you know, I did a lot of that. So in ninth grade, you know, I wasn't a very good student. I had a 0.67 GPA, which is the equivalent of 4 F's and 2 C's. And my 2 C's were in PE and Spanish. And, and it only got worse. In 10th grade, I ended up getting kicked out of school. I was someone that, you know, I would much rather drink and get loaded than do anything else. I'd much rather do that than hang out with my family. I'd much rather do that than go to school. I'd much rather do that than go to work. I'd much rather do that than have sex. I'd much rather do that. And as time went on, more and more things just started getting less and less of a priority where, you know, at 17 years old, my parents gave me the choice: you got to quit drinking and drugging or you got to leave. You have little brothers and sisters, you're a bad influence on them. You know, make your choice. And whenever presented with the choice, you got to quit drinking and drugging or, you know, I had to choose or. And I voluntarily went homeless in order to reserve my right to drink. And for about 2.5 years, I would, not really have a consistent place to stay. And, you know, in that time, at first it was fine because I was, you know, I would hang out with friends and sometimes I would stay at people's houses, but then I would try to, you know, steal something from them or sneak into little sister's room and they would ask me to leave, you know. And so then, you know, I started sleeping outside, and that's not as fun as it might sound, you know. Like if I could, I would sleep in abandoned places, some place where nobody was living, and preferably in a two-story place, because I could sleep in a top story, and if they had water running, that would be even better. But I would sleep in a top story, and then I could hear if the cops were running up the stairs, and I would just open up the window, you know, jump out, look back, and then, you know, jump to the floor. And, like, not very safe, right? Like, to be doing that type of stuff. But nonetheless, that's what was going on. At first, I could get money pretty easily. I was working. And then I had to get loaded more and more and more. So I would get I would quit before they would fire me. And then I had, you know, I started robbing people. Started off with stealing stuff and then robbing people. And then I became this homeless guy that was afraid to be outside. You know, alcohol and drugs had given me this great solution to that internal battle that I had. And it was no longer covering that up. You know, so when I hear people say alcohol stopped working, for me, it's not that I couldn't get loaded. I couldn't feel a buzz or feel a high. It's that I knew what I was doing at all. You know, like I just knew the life that I was living. I couldn't numb it anymore. So I started doing the jail thing, and I wouldn't call anyone. I would just stay in there. You know, I really did not like myself. And I thought, why would I bother anyone with my miserable existence? You know? So I'd stay in there and then come out, and hopefully I had a couple bucks to get back home. And the farthest, north I would go from where I lived was to go to jail, and the farthest south was like Mexico, so I could drink, you know, like down there. And the neighborhood that I lived at, I could, you know, basically go into a liquor store at 15 years old and get some alcohol just because, I don't know, they, you know, like people were afraid of the way that I looked, you know, because of, I associated with certain people. And I wasn't even a tough guy. I don't pretend to be a tough guy, but, in my mind I wanted to be. And maybe for a long time I tried to be, but I really wasn't. I was just always afraid. I went to this wedding, and it could have been a funeral. I don't really know. I just know that people were dressed up and they were drinking, and I was there, and I was not an invited guest. And I'm still in their alcohol and stuff. And the party ends, and I go to this after party, and we do a beer run, and then we're doing some other stuff there as well. And I stole someone's pager. Right? Because that's what was going on back then. that's, you know, like you would steal someone's pager and you would wait about a month before they disconnected it and then you would sell it. Yeah. But I stole this pager from someone that I shouldn't have been stealing from. And I had to get out of this. I had to leave this party. It was about 5 a.m. and I'm walking through this empty field and I see a shooting star. And I made a wish on the shooting star to be successful. And I don't really know what my idea of success was at the time, but I can tell you that I felt like misery dipped in shit, you know? So I'm walking and this dog comes up and starts sniffing my leg and I'm afraid of birds. I haven't slept in 10 days, so I'm afraid of birds by this time, let alone dogs. And I kick the dog and I continue to walk and I look back and it's angry, you know, and it's chasing me. So I start running. And my parents' house was before the Connect's house, and even, you know, they had told me not to stop by that early, but I had nowhere else to go. And so anyways, but I ran to my parents' house because this darn dog was chasing me, you know. And so I bang on my brother's window, and he lets me in, and I wake up something like a day and a half later, and this guy's telling me something about some rehab. And I don't really know exactly what he said. I used to have this great story about what he told me, but I don't even remember what he looked like, to tell you the truth. You know, like, I remember somebody was there and they said something, I don't know. So after that, I whenever I would go home, I would take a shower, get something to eat, and steal some money. And I did that, and I met up with a buddy of mine up in a tree, because I figured the cops can't see you, you know, if you're up in the trees. And so we're up there, and it's like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the trees where I lived were maybe about as high as I am right now. So like, so everyone could see us, right? And we're, you know, we're smoking weed up there also. So like, there's smoke coming out of this thing. And so I start telling my buddy about this guy and this, you know, he had suggested rehab, I think, and you know, in this whole scenario. And and you know, I'm telling him, and his response is, "I think you should go to rehab." You know, and for whatever reason, I decided to listen to this guy. You know, and I got loaded that day, and I got loaded the next day, and then my my parents paid $95 for me to go to this place for 97 days. So it was a real high quality place, in beautiful Garden Grove, California. And so I go there, and you know, the whole thing's kind of weird. But after about 3 days, I'm like, man, this sobriety thing freaking sucks. You know, like, I'm not feeling the promises at all. And so I decide to leave, and I walked outside, and I, you know, and this guy that had 18 days was smoking out there, and he starts talking to me. And as a result, so I was ready to leave. I saw the liquor store on the way in. I'm pretty sure I could find someone to buy alcohol for me. You know, I'm 19 at this point. And you know, he starts talking to me. And again, I don't know his name. I don't know what he said. I kind of remember what he looks like. Him having 18 days talking to me about staying sober, about whatever the hell we talked about, helped me stay sober that day. You know? And that's how this program works. One alcoholic talking to another. You know, hopefully not planning on getting loaded. And, you know, like, but that's how this thing works. You know, that's how it started with Bill and Dr. Bob, and that's how it continues to work. So I walked back in, but after about 7 days of detox, they sent me home for a day because there was no room in the recovery side of the rehab or something. One of my friends had been killed a couple days before, and it was literally one house over behind my house, and I felt really guilty. I felt that if I was there, whatever, some, you know, maybe things would have been different. They wouldn't have, but that's the way I felt. And that was, you know, in retaliation for a year before to the day, I was being stingy that day. I had a little bag of something and I didn't want to share. And a couple of buddies of mine got in the back of a car, and you know, the driver went to a neighborhood he shouldn't have gone to, and the guy in the front, you know, ended up killing someone in front of his house. And so I should have been there, right? Like, but at that point, for whatever reason, you know, drugs saved my life, or saved that life, you know. But because those guys are still in prison, even though, you know, for the two guys in the back seat, it was the first offense. And I can go off on a tangent about that. But anyway, so my friend was killed, and I used that as an excuse to relapse. And, you know, I was loaded after about 2 seconds, you know, and, I started burning more and more bridges. And after about 3 days, I had, some more not so nice people trying to do not so nice things to me. And, so I had to get out of there, and, I tried to get a hold of my parents, and I don't think they were talking to me anymore at this point. And I was trying, you know, I was trying to get a ride back up to this rehab. I figured that would be like my saving grace. I know that today that's not the case, you know, that I don't go somewhere and get cured and then live a normal life. I know today that I have to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous daily in order for me to be happy, you know. And if I'm not happy for long enough, I'm going to get loaded. You know, like, what other choice do I have? I have a friend that had 22 years sober and passed away about a month ago. But about 6 months ago, he stopped going to meetings and just went to church. And I love church. I go to church every Sunday. But I know that I have to come here, and I have to do this deal in order for me to stay sober anyway. So that happened, and after 5 months of not going to meetings, he ended up taking his life. I'm sure there's probably a more complicated story to that, but the big story for me is stop doing AA, and you know, so I have to do this deal, you know, and so I got loaded, you know, 3 days, no one's giving me a ride. Finally, I get a hold of this girl that I had dated when I was like 15 years old. And she said she would give me a ride to rehab if I gave her $20 and didn't talk to her on the way there. And I said, you know, and I said, you got a deal, you know? So I stole $20 from my mom, and I gave it to her, and she gave me a ride up there. And, you know, I went into this place, and they would suggest several different things. They would suggest things like getting a sponsor, connecting with a higher power, going to meetings, being a service. I forget what the last one is. I'm sure it'll come to me. Anyways, I would pick and choose the things that I was willing to do. I thought that service was doing chores at rehab. Come to find out, that's not the case. You know, and so I would do those because they made me. A sponsor, sure, I'll get someone that's, you know, that that I call sponsor, but I'm not going to work with them. I'm not going to call them or do any of that type of stuff. And you know, today, I forgot to say this. Today I have a sponsor that knows he's my sponsor. And he knows he's my sponsor because I call him. And I say, like, hey, sponsor, I got this, going on. And he'll say, well, have you talked to God about it? Have you done a 10 step about it? You know what? I think you're being really selfish. You know, and he'll say things like that, and then he'll give me some sort of solution on what to do after that. I didn't do that in the beginning. So I kept on putting my twist on this program. I kept on changing the rules up a little bit. And as a result, I kept on twisting my ass running out of these doors. I was in rehab, and we had, me and a couple buddies, we decided we were gonna get some women, get a motel room, get them drunk and have a good time, you know, and, what happened was I got drunk and no one had a good time. You know, I had planned on not drinking. We went to the gas station. We went and got some Miller High Life. As soon as I got in the car, I cracked it open and started drinking. You know, like, and I, up to the second before the alcohol was in front of me, that was my plan. Don't drink. Go hook up. It's going to be a good time. And, you know, I went back to this motel room and I robbed these women, and these not so nice people wanted to do not so nice things to me after I scared the women off. And, you know, and it was complete chaos, and it was by far not my worst drunk, but it was sufficient enough to bring about recovery. And I believe that was December 18th, 1997. So my sobriety date, I believe, is December 19th, 1997. And the reason I say that is, you know, when I was getting sober, I didn't think to myself, oh, you know what, this is going to be the day, you know, and, you know, I just had not, you know, I had no intention of, you know, getting sober and what have you. So let me just adjust some of my books, because the more recovery part is probably going to start coming in pretty soon. So what? So I go back into this rehab after I relapse. I lie. I graduate with honors, and then I go home and I think I'm cured, like I was telling you guys earlier. And so I think I'm cured, and I go, and I guess I should check the time. And I decided, you know, I don't need to go to meetings anymore. But, you know, after, because I had to do some court stuff and because I was being physically violent with my family members, I had to start doing 12-step meetings, and I had to pee test in front of some guy. And I had to do, like, group counseling. And during these group counseling sessions, I met this guy named Frankie. And Frankie was a 45-year-old cowboy from Nevada. And he used to talk about climbing up trees and shooting at shadows. And I'm like, I climb trees. You know, so I identified with this guy right away. And I started hanging out with him, you know, and what was great about Frankie is, he would come to my, you know, pick me up, and I lived like, you know, in a not so great neighborhood, and he had like a mullet and, you know, pants that were way too tight, you know, and he would pick me up, and we would go to meetings, and we would talk trash on you guys all the way to the meeting. And then, you know, we would, you know, talk trash on you guys all the way back home, and, you know, and be like, oh, can you believe her? Oh, she's such a slut, you know, and all that type of stuff. And I guess I should say this. I say a lot of, stereotypical chauvinist stuff, from this point, you know, backwards from my story. And the reason is that's how I felt and that's how I believe. Today, that's definitely not the type of person that I am. Today I'm a gentleman. I open doors. I walk on the side of the sidewalk, you know, closest to the street. I don't insult women. I don't insult gay people. I don't insult people of a different race or nationality. I don't insult people of a different religion. To the best of my ability, I don't do those things today. But I was not a good person before I came here, so that's why all that stuff is coming out. So, excuse me for just throwing that up right there, but I just don't speak that way unless I'm talking about the old me. So what happened? So I start going. So Frankie would pick me up, take me to meetings, and.